Hello.
I hope you're enjoying the first blushes of spring and
enjoying this beautiful weather that we're experiencing here this weekend. Today we have an encore interview, the best of the best of Take Charge of Your Health, with Dr. Robert Lustig, pediatric endocrinologist and author of Fat Chance: Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. It's a great show, so listen and enjoy, and I'll be back next week. Welcome back. Welcome back. This is Take Charge of Your Health, and I'm Corrine Fornari, clinical nutritionist and physician assistant. And every week, I present you with new and creative ways to help you make sense of health information and bring it home to you and your family. With years of clinical experience and research into traditional and cutting-edge technologies, I give you practical information to help you take charge of your health. And keeping with that tradition today, we have quite a blockbuster show. Today we will be literally smashing a few very dearly held myths. Many of you know Dr. Robert Lustig. He's been on my show before with a very important interview on high fructose corn syrup. Well, he's written a book. It's brand new out, just brand new. It's called Fat Chance: Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. And it's already bestseller, New York Times. Why? Why is it? Because this is an epidemic, pandemic of obesity and ill health, and nobody has come forward to give us any assistance or any answers. We all in deep inside know it's because people just have no self-control. They relate to gluttony and then they sit on the couch like couch potatoes. But is there a flaw in that thinking? We all know, and I see this in my office, people come in for help with food cravings and weight loss, but yet they know everything about weight loss. They know that a calorie is a calorie. They have a little computer program on their iPads showing how many calories they eat in a day and what they're eating and how. But yet, is there a flaw in that thinking? Is a calorie burned a calorie burned? A calorie burned is a calorie burned, but a calorie eaten, is that the same or is not? Is it different? Is it a calorie eaten? And therein lies the key to understanding the obesity pandemic. Calories in, calories out. And that's what we've been taught, and that's where we've been going. I want to read this one little section, and then we will go directly to Dr. Lustig. Food is sustenance. Food is survival. Most importantly, food is pleasure. And food matters. Unfortunately, now food matters even more than it should. Food is beyond necessity. It's been reformulated to be an addictive substance. This has many effects in our world, economically, politically, socially, and medically. There is a price to pay, and we're paying for it now. We're paying with our taxes, our insurance premiums, and on our airline fares. Nearly every bill we receive in the mail has an obesity surcharge that we're underwriting. We pay in declining school stores. We pay in death rates. We pay for all of it one way or another because the current food environment we have created does not match our biochemistry. And this mismatch is at the heart of our medical, social, and financial crisis. Worse yet, there is no medicine for this. There's no quick fix, but it is solvable if we know what's really going on and if we really want to create the change. Dr. Lustig, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me, Corinne.
It's really a pleasure. I've been watching you through, you know, when you first came on, I happened to be searching the internet and I saw that there was a lecture that you had given and it was so profound. And about 275,000 people had clicked in and watched it. And I watched it. I was just riveted. And then I called you and you very graciously came on our show. Well, that interview that we had has been played a couple of times since then. But I also went to look at that the YouTube lecture that you gave. You have over 3 million hits on it. Why do you think people are so interested? What is going on that's causing people and drawing people to hear a scientific lecture on fructose and sugar and how it affects our metabolism?
Corinne, if I had the answer to that, I'd be a very rich man today. But I think the reason that people are interested in this video is because they recognize that the current status of this obesity and metabolic disease epidemic that we find ourselves in is not being solved by our current thinking. Eat less, exercise more, just doesn't work. It hasn't worked, and to be honest with you, when you understand the science, you realize it's not going to work. And the fact that it keeps being shoved down our throat by the federal government, by the food industry, and to be honest with you, by the medical profession, you know, has people saying there must be an alternative answer. In addition, you look and you look at America and say, well, okay, you know, maybe we're just a bunch of gluttons and sloths, but you know what? This is occurring worldwide. This is occurring in places that still have undernutrition. How can you have overnutrition and undernutrition in the same country? And not only that, but every country in the entire world has shown an uptick in obesity rates. Can it be that everyone is now a bunch of gluttons and sloths? You know, there's just, it defies rational thinking. So people are looking for another explanation.
And you wrote this book, and I'm going to tell the audience, this book is amazing. I'm sitting there taking notes on every page, underlining, highlighting, because it shows the metabolism of our metabolism and how it relates to food and how it's shifted by food. It also explains hormonal relationships and metabolism. And I found that very, very powerful. There's a statement in your book, obesity is a biochemical alteration in the brain. Could you explain that to us, please?
All right. We have a hormone in our body called leptin, okay? And leptin is made by your fat cell. And when your fat cell gets filled, leptin levels in your blood go up. That leptin then goes to your brain and tells your hypothalamus, which is the area of your brain that controls hormonal processes, it says, hey, I've got enough energy on board to engage in normal and expensive metabolic processes. I can burn energy at a normal rate, I can feel like exercising, and I don't have to eat as much, and I can engage in reproductive competency because I have enough energy on board to do so. I can devote extra energy, for instance, to carrying a pregnancy. So leptin is extraordinarily important in keeping bodily function normal. If your brain can't see your leptin signal, and that can occur for two different reasons, one being you don't have any leptin, which is 14 people in the world, because they have a genetic defect in leptin, or because something is blocking that signal from reaching the brain, and we call that leptin resistance, which is the rest of the 1.7 billion people on the planet. Instead of their being leptin deficient, they're leptin resistant. But the bottom line is the same. If your brain can't see the leptin signal, your brain interprets that as starvation. Your brain thinks you're starving, even though you're not, even though your fat cells are perfectly filled. But the signal that would normally tell your brain that everything's okay is not reaching its target. And when that happens, your brain says, well, gee, if I'm starving, then I need to cut back on energy expenditure. In other words, get really complacent and sit on the couch. In other words, sloth. And I'm going to get really hungry because I need to generate more energy to put into more fat cells in order to generate a higher leptin level, and that's called gluttony. In other words, the two behaviors that we associate with obesity, gluttony and sloth, increased intake, decreased expenditure, are actually the result of a biochemical alteration in the brain. The question is, okay, how come 1.7 billion people have this problem when 30 years ago they didn't? What has changed in 30 years to make this biochemical and neural process occur? And that's what the book is about.
Now, I'm going to step back just a little bit on this one because I think my audience would appreciate understanding just a little bit. You made a very important statement here, and I want the audience to understand this. You said in your book, you say biochemistry drives behavior, not behavior drives the biochemistry. Can you explain that to us?
Sure, absolutely. Every behavior that we see on the planet is driven by some biochemical or genetic or physiological reaction. Things that we normally assume as being behavioral are actually not. Sometimes we're smart enough to know what the biochemistry is. In a lot of cases, we're not. But the bottom line is, it's all biochemical. Einstein knew it. Watson and Crick knew it. Philosophers going back hundreds of years intimated it. Obviously, we don't like the idea of our free will being infringed on. And so the concept that we have control over our behavior has been promulgated in the courts and, of course, in public media. Let me give you three examples of medical conditions that look like their behavior but are really biochemistry. I'm a pediatric endocrinologist. I take care of kids with diabetes, right? Well, there's another kind of diabetes. It's called diabetes insipidus. These kids drink and urinate like there's no tomorrow. So when a kid shows up in my office and they're drinking 10 gallons of water a day and urinating 10 gallons of water a day, The first thing that I think of is that they have a biochemical defect in a hormone called vasopressin, which is the water-retaining hormone, the camel hormone, that works at the kidney to hold on to water. Now, is it possible they have a behavioral disorder? Could they be a psychogenic water drinker? You know, it's 200 diabetes insipidus patients to every one psychogenic water drinker. So you see the behavior, and immediately you infer the biochemistry. Give you another one. You see a 25-year-old who falls asleep in his soup. What's he got? He's got narcolepsy. It turns out narcolepsy is a defect in a neurotransmitter called orexins in the midbrain that normally control attention and wakefulness. And finally, the big kahuna, the one everybody's familiar with, schizophrenia. For 100 years, schizophrenia was a behavioral disorder, and now we know that schizophrenia is really a defect in dopamine neurotransmission within the brain because it's a biochemical disorder. So here are three different medical problems that I have to take care of. And if you don't know that the biochemistry is underlying it, you can't take care of them properly. Well, guess what? Obesity is no different.
Well, obesity has been such a pariah in the medical office. An overweight person or an obese person goes in, they have hypertension, or they have the beginning of any heart problems or heart disease, or they have the beginning of diabetes, and they're told, here's a piece of paper, go home and lose weight. And yet.
And of course they can't.
They can't. Or That's they right. might lose some weight, but then it comes right back. Right back exactly. with a vengeance. And actually, it comes back higher than it was in the beginning. What
exactly
is,
right.
Exactly. And so we see the problem, but we're not getting guidance. So what is causing this this inability to deal with the weight that 50 years ago didn't exist?
Well, as I mentioned, there's a problem with leptin. So if your brain can't see your leptin, your brain thinks you're starving, it's going to make you want to eat more. So then your doctor goes and tells you, hey, lose weight, eat less. So what happens? Now your fat cells are not getting filled, therefore your leptin levels are going to go down. But you know what? Now you've got leptin deficiency on top of leptin resistance. Now your brain really doesn't see the leptin because it's not even, you know, because it's actually gone down in level. And so what do you think happens? You get more gluttonous and more slothy. That's the recidivism of obesity right there. Until we solve the problem of what's going on in the brain, what is that biochemical reaction that is preventing that leptin signaling, you can't solve obesity. So that question then comes, okay, so what is it? What's the key to the kingdom?
Well,
what blocks leptin signaling?
Well, isn't it just diet and exercise?
No, of course not. If it were diet and exercise would work. And guess what? It doesn't. There's not one article anywhere in the medical literature that shows that exercise actually promotes weight loss. And you already know about how well diet works. Studies looking at the success of any given diet shows that any diet will work for the first 6 months, and then the weight comes roaring back. The number of patients, the percent of patients that can keep their weight off over a 10-year period is 1%.
1%.
That's not going to solve it. Mm-mm. So the question is, how do you solve the problem at the level of the brain? And for that, you have to understand what's going on. You have to understand the biochemistry, and I can sum that up in one word.
Okay.
Insulin. Insulin is the bad guy in this story.
Now,
so everybody's familiar with insulin. Everybody knows that insulin is the diabetes hormone, right? Diabetics take shots of insulin. Well, let's take a diabetic off the street. Blood sugar is 300. That's high. Normal is 100. We give them a shot of insulin in the arm. The blood sugar goes from 300 down to 100. That's good. The blood sugar went down by 200 points. Where did that 200 points of blood sugar go? They were in the blood, now they're not. Where did they go? They went to the fat for storage. Insulin takes sugar from the blood that you're not burning and puts it in fat for storage. And of course, that then makes your leptin levels rise. So insulin makes fat. More insulin, more fat. Turns out, insulin also is the hormone that blocks that leptin signal up in the brain. So when insulin goes up, not only do you gain weight peripherally, but it actually blocks the signal to the brain that says, hey, I've had enough. And so when your brain gets too much insulin and it can't see its leptin, it makes you hungrier and makes you want more. So insulin has a twofold effect in this story. It drives weight gain and it makes you think you're starving at the same time. That's a problem.
It's a big problem, particularly when we're dealing with diabetics, because just like you said, we take someone off the street, they have a 300 blood sugar. We really do not check their insulin level at all. So
we don't need to check their insulin level. What we need to do is we need to actually get their insulin down.
Exactly.
Not up.
Exactly.
Down.
Exactly. We need to utilize other measures, because I see many people on insulin who are just getting fatter and fatter and fatter, and they can't stop the weight gain. If they lower the insulin, then what's happening is their blood sugar is not controlled. And they're not able to make that control on their own, and they're not getting assistance. Their doctor just says, build up their insulin, just keep their insulin higher and higher, and they're getting heavier and heavier with less and less
Here's
control. Pardon?
Here's the problem. Doctors will tell you, you have to take your insulin. And you know what? Even I say, if you're diabetic, you need to get your blood sugar down because high blood sugar is going to hurt you. But here's the thing that no doctor wants to tell their patient. And there are reasons why they don't want to tell them. And I'm just going to be honest and straight with your audience.
Please.
Insulin is both good and bad at the same time. It's always good and bad. It's good because it lowers your blood sugar. It's good because it actually regulates your metabolic rate in a rational way and keeps your blood sugar in the normal range. That's why it's good. The problem is insulin's also bad. Why is it bad? Because it actually causes cell proliferation, cell differentiation. It causes vascular smooth muscle proliferation in your coronary arteries, and it ultimately promotes things like heart disease, cancer, dementia. It's a growth factor. So what you want is you want the metabolic effects of insulin without the cell proliferation effects of insulin. Problem is, you can't split them up. You get both at the same time. So what you really want is you want the least amount of insulin that will do the job. And the only way to do that is to be insulin sensitive, not insulin resistant, because then your insulin levels have to go way high to overcome that resistance. And that's what diabetes is the ultimate insulin resistance. So how do you get from being insulin resistant to being insulin sensitive? And I can sum that up in one word also. It's called exercise. That's what exercise really does for you. That's why exercise is good, is because it lets you operate at a lower level of insulin. Think of it this way. When you consume any amount of energy, that energy has one of three fates. Either you can burn it, in which case you don't need any insulin at all, or you can store it, which has its downside. It's called obesity. And of course, you need insulin in order to be able to store it. Or the last fate is it goes out your kidney, in which case it fries your kidney and you're on dialysis. So of those three fates, which one sounds the best to you?
Sounds like burning is the best.
Absolutely. And that's why exercise is the answer to virtually every ailment that we have in terms of chronic metabolic disease. Exercise is the key to the kingdom. The problem is that doctors will tell their patients, hey, if you'd only exercise, you'd lose weight. But you don't lose weight because a calorie is not a calorie. What exercise does is it improves your insulin sensitivity. What exercise does is it gets your cortisol down, and cortisol is the stress hormone that causes most of these chronic diseases. What exercise does is it builds muscle, and muscle has mitochondria, and mitochondria are the little energy-burning factories inside each cell. That's what allows your body to burn the energy instead of having to store it. But the problem is muscle weighs more than fat. So when you exercise, it's actually likely you'll gain weight, not lose it. But that's good weight, not bad weight. The point is, if you're looking at the scale, you're going to be disappointed, you're going to stop exercising, you're going to get depressed, and you're going to eat more. So we've got doctors telling patients, if you'd only exercise, you'd lose weight. As far as I'm concerned, this is the greatest disservice the medical profession can perpetrate on a patient.
Well, we get that everywhere. Look at that. I've mentioned this before, the show, that degrading show, The Big Loser. If you exercise, you'll lose weight.
And they have their entire environment controlled. They don't just exercise. They are on, 500-calorie-a-day diets or 800-calorie-a-day diets. It's the dietary restriction that's promoting their weight loss. Yes, their exercise is very important. It's actually making them fitter, and it's allowing their leptin to start working because their insulin is coming down, and that's all good. And I'm not against exercise. I'm for it. I am absolutely for it. But you got to know what it's for. You got to know why you're doing it. And if you're doing it for weight loss, you're doing it for the wrong reason.
Now, this epidemic of weight gain is taking place worldwide, as you said. But we're also seeing it in lab animals, that they are larger than they used to be. What can you help us understand what is going on here?
Right. So there was a paper that came out 2 years ago that showed that over the past 20 years, even animals kept in captivity have shown an increase in weight gain. And they looked at 22 different species of animals, and they all showed the same increase in weight. And the question is, what is that? Well, it certainly can't be gluttony and sloth, and it certainly can't be diet and exercise. These were caged animals before. So the question is, what are they being exposed to that maybe, just maybe, we're exposed to as well? Could it be in the drinking water? Could it be in the in their lab chow pellets, you know, their processed food? So there are other things that we may be exposed to also that I talk about in the book called environmental obesogens. There are chemicals that we're all exposed to that can actually cause fat cell differentiation. The big one is estrogen. Estrogen is well known to do this. It's one of the reasons why women have that hourglass figure. Estrogen causes fat cell differentiation, and there are estrogens throughout our environment that we put there. One of them, the most famous one, is DDT, the insecticide. Now, we used DDT in this country until 1972, and then it was banned. The problem is you can still measure DDE, which is a metabolite of DDT, levels in the urine of pregnant mothers, and those levels in pregnant mothers predict obesity in their children at age 3 years old. So this is an environmental obesogen that we got rid of 40 years ago, and it's still wreaking havoc today. Is it possible that that's the reason lab animals are increasing their weight? Is that a possible reason why we have an epidemic of obese six-month-olds? And this is something that we do not have the capacity to control.
Well, what a six-month-old who's obese, you see that in your clinic. What
I do.
Exactly, and more and more. I feel that it has something. There are many, many, many factors. I think an important factor is that they're giving so much insulin to pregnant mothers. They're boosting up their insulin, and they're sensitizing these babies to high insulin levels, so they're hungry. They're hungry all the time. You can't satisfy them. What do you think? What do you see?
So, first of all, there is a rash of gestational diabetes in pregnant mothers. No question about it. The incidence has doubled over the past 15 years. The question is, how come we have all of these gestational diabetic mothers? What's causing gestational diabetes in these women? And we don't have the absolute answer to that. Obviously, one of the factors is the Western diet. The question is, what about the Western diet? And from our data and from other people's data, we can infer that the amount of sugar in our current diet is the proximate cause of these women's weight gain and their risk for gestational diabetes, and also the increase that we are seeing in infants' birth weight. Infants now weigh 200 grams more than they did 25 years ago when they're born. So there has been a demonstrable shift of energy storage even during gestation. And the question is, what's driving that? And we think, we don't know this yet, but based on the data and indirect inference, we're pretty sure that it's the sugar content of our current diet.
Well, I would think that that if you take these people, you know, many of these young women are from other countries. When they're in their own countries eating their environmental diets, this is not the problem that they are experiencing here when they're here eating the high refined food diets. I had a patient who came in to me, and she has a weight problem. I said, well, where are you from? She said, I'm from Puerto Rico. I said, is your family heavy? She said, no, whenever I go back there, they laugh at me and they call me the Americana, that because I've gained so much weight since I came here.
Yep.
So
I know. We've seen this in foreign fellows who've come over from Europe to work with us for 1 or 2 months. We had one young lady, absolutely rail thin, and her boyfriend told her, while you're in America, don't eat anything, because I like you the way you are. If you eat American food, you'll come back 20 pounds heavier. And so she ate the American food, and she came back 20 pounds heavier.
Well, if she goes back home, she'll lose it all.
No, she won't, Because
you don't
once
think
you
so.
Make those fat cells, they like to stay filled. And that's the, you know, that's sort of the double jeopardy of obesity. It's actually very difficult to get those fat cells to lose their fat once they've been made.
Dr. Lustig, we are going to be going to a break for just a second. We're speaking with Dr. Robert Lustig. He's the author of Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food Diet, and Obesity. He's a pediatric endocrinologist and running a clinic on obesity. And we will be right back. I'm Corrine Fornari, clinical nutritionist, physician assistant, and we will be right back. Thanks for listening.
I'm Ella Joyce, and when I'm in New York, I listen to WBAI 99.5 FM. The more you listen, the more you learn.
Allen, this is Nonfiction. And Nonfiction is the magazine of the arts, ideas, and fact, airing every Friday, 2 to 3 p.m. over WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. Tune in for a wide range of compelling topics, informed guests, and penetrating interviews. That's Fridays, 2 to 3 p.m., Nonfiction, over WBAI New York and WBAI.org.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Dr. Robert Lustig, pediatric endocrinologist, and he is the author of Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. So, Dr. Lustig, there's much, much, much more to say. Where do you want to dive back in?
Well,
I'll take it anywhere.
I think the thing that I really want people to understand is that just, look, 30% of America is obese. So that means that 70% of people think they're out of the woods and they have no problem. Wrong. That's a terrible mistake. And here's why. Yes, it's true, 30% of people are obese, but you know what? 20% of the obese have completely normal metabolism. They will live a completely normal life without any problems other than the fact that they're obese. They will live to a completely normal age and die of something else entirely. Conversely, up to 40% of the normal weight population have the same chronic metabolic diseases that the obese do, that is, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, lipid problems, cardiovascular disease, cancer, dementia. They have the same chronic metabolic dysfunction, but they're just not obese, so they don't know that they have the problem. If you take those people and you stick them in an MRI scanner and you look, they have as much fat in their bellies, in their bodies, as do the obese. They just don't have subcutaneous fat. And so when they stand on the scale, they think they're normal. Jimmy Bell, an imager at University College London, termed this TOFI, T-O-F-I, thin on the outside, fat on the inside. Well, the fact is 40% of the American population are TOFIs, and they're just as at risk for these same chronic metabolic diseases. So being thin is not a defense.
So then, what got us into this mess? Was it the low-fat diet?
I think, first of all, the reason I think this is occurring and the reason that I needed to write the book was because we moved from a real food diet to a processed food diet back in the 1960s and 1970s. And we did it for several reasons, a lot of it having to do with economics, a lot of it having to do with food supply and convenience, a lot of it having to do with two-parent working families. There were a whole bunch of reasons why this occurred. But in order to make a processed food diet, you had to do two things. You had to add the sugar for palatability, and you had to take away the fiber for shelf life. That is the definition of processed food. High sugar, low fiber. The definition of real food is low sugar, high fiber. And so I think that over the past 30 years, because of our move from a real food diet to a processed food diet, this problem has occurred. So I have said that sugar is the primary culprit in terms of this chronic metabolic disease because of the way sugar is handled. And the thing that basically prevented that from occurring was the fiber in the diet, because the fiber acts as a barrier on the inside of the intestine. So number one, you don't absorb it all. And number two, if you do absorb it, it's delayed. And that gives your liver a chance to catch up so your liver doesn't get sick. So my thought is that what we need to do is we need to get back to a more, a real food diet. Now, I'm not the only one who says this. Alice Waters says this for the aesthetic reasons of real food. Michael Pollan has said it for the socio-ecological reasons of real food. All I'm doing in Fat Chance is supplying the biochemical reasons. But the biochemical reasons are so compelling and so obvious, and you realize that there's no choice but to do it because there's no drug target for this, that this becomes a public health disaster as opposed to a personal responsibility issue. And that, I think, is why, number one, the YouTube video has taken off, and number two, the book is selling so well.
Let me ask you, does the government have any role in this that created some of
it? Absolutely.
Can you explain that to us?
What made this happen? The government is the reason why this has happened, because the government has subsidized processed food at the expense of real food.
Corn, soy.
Subsidies for broccoli.
No.
But there is government subsidies
or apples.
For corn and everything that corn makes, like high fructose corn syrup. So the government has been complicit in terms of fomenting this epidemic by veering us away from real food and toward processed food. The question is, can government bring us back? And the answer is only if they want to and only if we let them. And right now, we don't want to and we're not letting them.
We're not letting them, or they're afraid to. There are big lobbies. What about the farm bill? There are big lobbies. And it seems like people, the farm bill, and I will continue, subsidizes the corn industry, the soy industry, the wheat industry, all the foods which move into processed foods. Dr. Lustig? Okay, all the foods that move into processed foods. So at this moment, he's off the line. We'll be getting him right back on the line. I do want to mention, and this is so important, I want to mention a few things for young mothers. The Isomil. Isomil, the baby formula, is, and I want you to understand that, is 10.3% sugar that we're giving our newborns. And Coca-Cola is 10.5% sugar. So Isomil is like a baby milkshake, but it also has the genistein, the soy formula, which then changes the baby's hormones, and the also the bisphenol A, which comes in plastic bottles. All of those are estrogenic, which are a setup for food craving and obesity. It's quite a nightmare. We have to remember that sugar is an empty nutrient. It's not a calorie as a calorie. Sugar is literally sapping our body of nutrients that could be taken in. What happened was the people became afraid of fats. They were told to be afraid of fats. Well, fats are our flavor. Fats are our flavoring in our food. So in order, when we took all the fats out of the food, we replaced those fats with a sugar source. Dr. Lustig, welcome back.
Yes, I'm back.
Okay, so I was talking about how we took the fat out of food and replaced it with sugar to make it literally palatable.
That's right. Back in the 1970s, we, as a country, went low fat. And the question is, why did we do that? Back in the 1960s, 1970s, this country had a very large argument about what caused heart disease. Was it the fat or was it the sugar? And there were two factions, and to make a very long story short, the fat faction won, and they won based on incomplete and erroneous data. They basically said, well, if dietary fat raises your LDL level, or low-density lipoprotein, and LDL levels correlate with cardiovascular disease in general populations, which is true, then if we reduce the dietary fat, we'll lower the LDL and we'll prevent cardiovascular disease. That was the thought process back in the 1970s. And the McGovern Commission of 1977 was the first government agency to promote that concept. And we basically bought it hook, line, and sinker, and we went low fat back in the late 1970s. This is how Entenmann's fat-free cakes appeared, okay, and things, you know, on that order. And that's why we went to skim milk as well, and we took the fat out of milk in schools. Here's the problem. When you take the fat out, the food tastes like cardboard. The food tastes terrible. So the food industry knew that. They said, well, what are we going to do in order to make the food palatable? What are we going to substitute in order to make the food worth eating so that we can keep our sales up? The answer was sugar. So, as an example, Snackwells, they're still with us. 2 grams of fat down, but 13 grams of carbohydrate up, 4 of which were sugar. The question is, which was worse for us, the fat or the sugar? Without question, the answer is the sugar.
Well, you also talk about in your book, we're coming closer to the end, and I know it's amazing because you have another lecture coming right up, speaking with students at Stanford. So you're going from one talk to another. You're amazing in your energy, and I really...
My new life.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Thank you so much for sharing this with us. But you also talk about juice is worse than soda. You talk about that there's 5.8 teaspoons of sugar per cup of juice versus soda, 5.4 teaspoons of sugar per cup.
That's right. Calorie for calorie, gram for gram, ounce for ounce, juice is actually worse than soda. Now, a standard soda size would be 12 ounces, like a can. A standard size for juice would be 8 ounces, which is a cup. So an 8-ounce glass of juice has 120 calories, and a 12-ounce soda has 150 calories. But if you did it cc for cc, mm-hmm. gram for gram, ounce for ounce, juice actually has more fructose and more calories than soda does. And we don't think twice about letting our kids have a quart of orange juice a day. This is a problem.
But eating an orange would not be a problem. Because
the fiber mitigates the negative effects. So my friend and colleague and food activist, Cindy Gershon in the East Bay here in California, runs a food science class at Mount Diablo High School. And one of the first experiments that she does in the class is she takes two kids and she gives each one six oranges. And she says to the first one, here, make juice. So the kid makes juice out of the six oranges, comes to a little over 12 and a half ounces. Kid drinks the whole glass of juice and says, okay, what's for breakfast? The second kid, she gives the six oranges and she says, here, kid, eat the six oranges. Kid gets up to orange number four and throws up. Says, I couldn't possibly eat another bite. I am sick to my stomach. What happened? The fiber happened. The fiber in the oranges actually promoted satiety and made it so that this kid couldn't do it. In fact, how many oranges are rational to eat at one sitting? How about one?
One.
Okay. Did you ever see a kid eat two oranges at a sitting? Doesn't exist. So which would you rather have? 30 calories in one orange with boatloads of fiber, or 120 calories in a glass of orange juice with no fiber?
And ready for breakfast. And ready for breakfast.
Right. And ready for breakfast.
And ready for breakfast. Now, we're coming close to the end of the show, and it's just been wonderful. I could listen to you for hours. Actually, I wish I could fly over and listen to the lecture.
Not a problem.
But you have a whole list in your book on looking and understanding labels. You also say something, the more labels you have to read, the more junk food you're eating, no matter where it's coming from. Health food
Does
store.
Does real food need a label?
There's not many labels on broccoli.
Label. That's right. Real food doesn't require a label. So if the food has a label, that means it's been processed in some fashion.
Mm-hmm.
So what you need to know is not what's in the food. What you need to know is what's been added to the food and what's been taken away from the food. You need to know how it's been processed. And so 2 weeks ago, I had an op-ed in the San Francisco Chronicle out here basically saying that the food label needs to be reworked, not because we need to know what's in the food, but we need to know what's been put in or taken out, because that's the harm that's been done.
You also have a full chart, a whole page of different names for added sugar.
Now, 56 of them.
Now, I'm quite knowledgeable, but I was a little bit shocked for how to read a label and see really and truly how much added sugar is there. I was really quite surprised at the number that there were, and how by breaking up the different types of sugar, you can get that equivalent sweetness, but never really reveal what's in there.
Exactly. The food industry has to list the ingredients on the packaging by mass. So you can take different forms of sugar and make them number 5, number 6, number 7, number 8, number 9, but when you add them up, it's number 1. And the food industry can hide what it's doing by doing that. And the Food and Drug Administration allows them to do it, because the Nutrition Labeling and Education Act of 1990, which gave us nutrition facts, basically the food industry petitioned the FDA back in 1989 and said, hey, if we told the populace how much sugar we actually put in each of our products, our competitors could duplicate our recipes. This is proprietary information, and you're not allowed to know it. And you know what the FDA said?
Okay.
They said, oh, okay. And so for the last 23 years,
protecting our interests,
this has been perpetrated on the American public.
You also have a list, the 10 worst children's breakfast cereals. Number 1, Kellogg Honey Smacks, 55.6% sugar by weight. And the
now,
list goes on.
Do you think
on.
That that's okay? I don't. You know, I mean, Fruit Loops were on the smart choice list that the food industry made. They gave it that green check mark. And Fruit Loops isn't even the worst of the cereals. It's only at 41% sugar.
It's only number 10
on the list. But do you think that's a smart choice?
And young mothers read this and they don't really understand what's happening to their children, why they can't focus or think. Now, we're coming to the end of the show, Dr. Lustig. I would love you to, you know, give a couple sentences on what you really want the audience to have with them as they end this hour, and also your contact information.
I'm happy to do so, Corinne. Here's what your audience needs to know. You've been fed a line for the last, probably 50 years. And the line is, a calorie is a calorie. Well, if you believe a calorie is a calorie, then the food industry is right. Coca-Cola is right with their new ad. And right down the line, if a calorie is a calorie, then it's eat less, exercise more. You are what you eat. Whatever you put in your mouth, it's your choice. And good luck to you. That's if a calorie is a calorie. Well, guess what? A calorie is not a calorie. And you are not what you eat. You are what you do with what you eat. Because the metabolism of different foodstuffs is completely different, and they cause disease in different ways and in differing amounts. So what you eat is much more important than how much you eat. So a calorie is not a calorie. And if you believe that, then all hell breaks loose. And what you need to do is get your insulin down by reducing the amount of sugar and the amount of refined carbohydrate in your diet. Now, lots of people have been saying this, from Gary Taubes through Michael Pollan through me and whole bunches of other people, the low-carb people, the paleo people. The bottom line is there are a whole bunch of diets, and you know what? They all work. There's the Atkins diet. There's the Ornish diet. There's the glycemic index diet. There's the paleo diet. There's the South Beach diet. And they all share two things in common: low sugar, high fiber. So you know what a low sugar, high fiber diet is called? It's called real food. And that's what this is really about. As we've moved away from real food to processed food for convenience, for expense, you know, because of, the food industry itself and the changes that were made there, the bottom line is we've gotten sicker and we're going to continue to get sicker until we turn this around. And the only way to turn it around right now is with your audience's vigilance and with their activism. And because of that, we are starting a nonprofit entity here in San Francisco called Nutrition Initiatives for Global Health, and we will be taking on the food industry.
Ah, I congratulate you. I really do. I love your work. I will be following you. I hope you will be able to come back and share the progress with our audience. We're speaking with Dr. Robert Lustig, author of the book Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. Dr. Lustig, do you have an address for the group you're starting?
At the moment, we're still in the process of getting IRS tax exemption status, so we're not quite there yet, but people can actually go to my Facebook page, robert.lustig, at earthlink.net, and also Facebook/Robert Lustig, and find me, and they will be able to communicate and also sign up to help us in this process.
Thank you so much for being such a people's advocate and children's advocate, such an unprotected population.
When you take care of kids, you have to do right by them. This is the way.
Thank you. Thanks for being here with us. We've been speaking with Dr. Robert Lustig, Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. And I'm Corinne Fornari, clinical nutritionist, physician assistant. And you can see me on my Facebook page, Corinne Fornari, F-U-R-N-A-R-I, R-P-A-C-C-N. And I'll be putting up quotes from the book Fat Chance. You'll be learning a lot. And my website is fornarihealth.com, F-U-R-N-A-R-I, health, H-E-A-L-T-H.com. And my office number, 212-586-2100. Thank you for sharing this time with me, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.